What is going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Mind Over Macros podcast. As always, I am your host, Mike Milner. Today, I was joined by a special guest. I had the founder of Spartan, Joe DeSena, on the show. And this was a really compelling conversation for me personally. I enjoyed hearing Joe talk about how Spartan was created, why it was created, and kind of what it has meant to all of the various participants, including myself, who have done Spartan races over the years, and kind of the mission that he's on, and some incredible stories as well, and just overall life lessons. If you are struggling with anything, if you're carrying something right now that's holding you down a little bit, this is going to be for you. This episode will help in a lot of ways. If you listen and actually put things into practice, that's always the key, right? Learning is great, but doing is even better. So the process that I like to follow is listen, absorb, and then we reflect, and then we do. So don't forget that last part, which is the doing. If you enjoy this episode, we always love it when you can spread the love, share this with people who need to hear it. And one of the best ways to do that is by taking a screenshot of the episode and posting it to Instagram. And you can share it to your stories. And then you can tag both Joe and myself. My handle is @coach_Mike_Milner. And you can tag Joe @RealJoeDeSena. It's Real Joe, DeSena. And as always, we appreciate the ratings and reviews. We're heading towards 1,000 five-star ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts alone, which is incredible. And as you know, every single Wednesday, we give away a free supplement of your choice to any one of our sponsors, Cured Nutrition, Organifi, or Legion Athletics, just by leaving a five-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. So if you open the podcast app on your phone, you hit the search button, you type in Mind Over Macros, you'll tap on the show, you'll scroll down until you see the ratings and reviews, you leave a five-star review, and you're eligible to win. It's that simple. And the last thing is you should be following the show or subscribed on whatever platform you are listening on. Just hit the follow button, the subscribe button. It just notifies you when new episodes are released every Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And that's all I got for our housekeeping notes. With that being said, let's get into the conversation. All right. What's up, everybody? I've got a special guest on the show today. I have Joe DeSena, who has a lot of accomplishments, New York Times bestselling author, started Spartan, did the Iditarod by foot, which is pretty crazy. And then one that I just learned recently is that apparently you lost 400 pounds in like 18 months. Is that right?
No, actually I helped a guy. It's funny because I've seen a few articles and things about me losing 400 pounds, but I helped a guy lose four. Thanks for having me, by the way, lose 400 plus pounds. He came to our farm. He weighed, 696 pounds, stayed with us on and off for 18 months. Had him carrying a sandbag, 20-pound sandbag every day, doing 10 miles in the morning, 10 miles a night, only eating raw fruits and vegetables. We got him down to 265 pounds. That story has somehow gotten morphed in the digital ecosystem that I lost all that weight, which I did lose some weight, but I never got that big.
Okay, gotcha. Was that pre or post Spartan era when that happened?
That was during Spartan, and Spartan stumbled upon this gentleman who was at one of our races. He did not know what he was getting into when he showed up to the race at 696 pounds. I heard about him, called him, and said, "You have to move to the farm. You have to convince your employer to release you, give you like some sort of a moment where you can come fix yourself." And I was shocked to learn that he was eating 8 Egg McMuffins and drinking 2 2-liter Sprites every day, which got him to that size. He's a great guy. And we worked together. We got in some fights along the way because expectedly his brain was saying, "Get me the fuck out of here. This guy's crazy. I want to go back to eating Egg McMuffins," right? Any brain would do that. And we got through it. And he ultimately did a Spartan Beast. He ultimately sat in one chair on the plane on his way home, which, you know, he teared up because he hadn't sat in one seat in a long time. The pants that he had when it was just an unbelievable story.
Yeah, this is amazing. Have you kept in touch with him since then?
A little bit here and there. He's had some other challenges in his life, but yeah, he gained a little bit back. He has not gained it all back. So, you know, I think somebody like you, me, the listener says, well, why can't that person just, you know, it's hard. What got you there to begin with, right, is never truly undone. And it's easy, by the way, easier, I should say, when you're on a farm where I take your keys, I take your wallet, and you're under direction, like you probably and myself would love it if every day somebody like did, you know, pushed me the way we push our kids or like the way I pushed him, because it makes it easier. You gotta do it on your own. It's another, you know, it's a battle.
Yeah, there's a lot of layers to it. What was the origin story of Spartan? How did that all come to be?
So we got to go back all the way to the 1970s. I was a little kid. My mom's mom, my grandmother had cancer. We lived in a neighborhood that was Goodfellas. It's where the movie was actually filmed. And the story was generated from this neighborhood I grew up in. And, you know, people didn't take care of themselves. Lifestyles were terrible. There's lots of cigarettes and cigars and drinking and cannolis and, you know, you name it, but very unhealthy lifestyles. And my mom wanted to find another way for her mother. So she went into a health food store. When she walked into that health food store, she met a yogi. He'd just come from India. He believed in meditation. He believed in yoga. He believed in being a vegan, convinced my mom, also believed in long distance running, convinced my mom to start running 10 miles a day. He developed a race in Queens that still exists today called the Transcendence Run. It's a 3,100 mile foot race around a 1 mile loop. You just go in circles. My mom got into it all. I didn't want any part of it as a kid. I thought it was weird. I just wanted an eggplant parm hero. I wanted to hang out with my buddy, Anthony Catapano. And yeah, I just had a moment there. I was thinking Anthony didn't make it. He's not with us anymore. So I there was a moment of silence there. And sorry for the pause. But mom kept pushing. Fast forward later in life, I'm on Wall Street, not feeling well. I had pushed back on everything that yogi and my mom had said throughout the years. And then I found myself feeling unhealthy, went in and did a hot yoga class, met a guy carrying dumbbells in the stairwell. It's mid-90s. It was hook, line, and sinker. I got hooked. I found every race I could possibly do around the world. My mother was right. I started eating healthy. I found a guy named Dr. Fred Bishi who believed in raw fruits and veggies. Like I went nuts. When I get on something, it's like I'm all in. And I had a blast. Had a blast doing it. And that led to one day sitting on the trading desk and saying, maybe I could turn this into a business. You know, and so here we are.
What did you see that was missing? Like when you went around, did all these races, like why wasn't that enough? Or what did you see as the gap in the marketplace at that time?
Well, it didn't really exist. I mean, you're talking about, I started this 25 years ago. So there were a couple of mom and pop runs. Certainly the marathons existed. But, you know, could this be done at scale? Could it be badass? Could it be like earning a badge of honor? And quite frankly, from the first 10 years, I couldn't make it work. I couldn't convince people to come. Facebook and social media and email marketing stuff was like brand new. It didn't really exist. It was only, you know, after 10 years of losing money and really a moment when I should have quit, the business wasn't working, that all of a sudden it caught fire. I changed the format. The name Spartan started to resonate. A bunch of veterans started coming back from the Middle East from war. CrossFit was taken. Like it just was a moment. And don't forget, back then, you could gain a follower on Facebook for like a penny. Literally, today it's, you know, $10. So it was a little easier to reach people and at scale. So we were able to build a brand. We spent more money than small countries spend on their annual budgets. But we built a brand. We went global. And it finally started, it finally got profitable. It finally was on its way to, you know, me being able to pound my chest and say, hey, look what we did. And then COVID hit and took the wind right out from our sails.
Has it recovered since then?
Well, it recovered the day, so we got shut down and I had already sold 450,000 tickets that year and I couldn't deliver on that promise. You know, somebody paid $100, $150, $200. I couldn't deliver on what I had sold. So they, rightfully so, they wanted their money back, but I couldn't give them the money back because I had already spent it getting ready for the races that were coming. And so I offered everybody two tickets. I wanted to be honorable and the world was only going to be shut down for a few weeks. So I said, everybody's got two tickets. So I gave away 900,000 tickets. And when I opened the world back up 2 years later for us and launched 250 events across 45 countries at once, which meant booking 250 venues, starting trucks and trailers, hiring back 400 people, the amount of cash needed to do all that was unbelievable. In addition, the first $90-100 million of revenue we didn't get because I had given those tickets away for free. So we were completely upside down. But to answer the question, the business came back. Like people came back. We just didn't get any money. And then, you know, the second year, which was last year, was equally tough because then we owed a bunch of people money, a bunch of vendors, et cetera. And then this year, knock on wood, by the end of this year, all our blemishes are gone. I'm back to being a, you know, back to people wanting to shake my hand and look me in the eyes and thinking I'm a decent human being. But oh my God, it's been the toughest 3.5 years of my life.
I can imagine. What kept you going during the 10 years of not being profitable, spending the money, not making it work? What kept you going and believing in the mission?
Well, I want to say that I'm incredibly resilient and I don't quit. But when you ask that question, I think, don't forget, I was making money on Wall Street. So I still had my foot on, you know, in that world. So I could afford to meddle around and play around with this thing and try to get it to work. It was really an advanced hobby. I don't like to quit. I didn't want to give up on it. This is something you shouldn't do in business, but I did, which was, well, shit, I already invested X. I might as well put more, right? And then you just keep doing that. You keep putting, you know, good money after bad. And really in 2010, you know, coming out of financial crisis of 2009, I shouldn't have continued. I think at that moment I was about to quit. But then I put one more race on and 700 people showed up. And I was like, oh my God, that's unbelievable. We got something here. I happened to have a guy with me at that race who came from Discovery Channel, whose job it was to look at shows and see, are they worthy of being on the air? And he said, you see what's going on here? And I said, no, what's going on here? He said, people are literally transforming in front. Look how they look at the start line. Look how they... And he put a different spin on the whole thing for me that really clarified what it is we do. We don't put on race. Like, that's not what we do. What we do, we change lives, right? Like a podcast, my podcast or your podcast doesn't really change a life. A book doesn't really change a life. A conference doesn't really change. Therapist doesn't really change a life. When you do hard shit and your back's against the wall, that's when life changes, yeah. Right? That's when life changes. So we provide the forum, the vessel for somebody to get to their lowest of lows, to hate themselves, to cry, to not want to take another step, to lose their shoe, their hands are bleed. Like that's when transformation takes place.
Yeah, completely. Is that what you find? Is that what, was that the, I guess, just your audience, the common commentary of just, this was the thing that pulled me out of a dark place, or I needed to put myself through something difficult and show myself that I'm resilient. Was that kind of the message that you were getting?
I mean, I recently went out. I haven't released a video yet, but I ran around. Rivian gave me some money to run around and go interview a bunch of our customers. And I took, 4 weeks, borrowed a buddy of mine's Rivian, and we just ran around and filmed and went up to folks and said, tell me your story. And I didn't curate it. So I had no idea what I was going to get. I suspected you were going to hear, like you just asked, like, change my life, this and that. But every single person, didn't matter who I went up to, no planning, just beeline for that man or woman and ask them. Every single person had a story that would blow you away. And so then you say to yourself, do we only attract people that have to go through a transformation that are experiencing something in their life? And then you realize, no, actually everybody needs this. Everybody's got something. Like, who do you know that's not experiencing some problem, something, right? And this becomes the change agent. This is the change agent. And, you know, I did a lot of marathons. I did a lot of Ironmans. I did a lot of ultras. I did all kinds of things around the world myself. And for some reason, like, a marathon doesn't really do it. A triathlon doesn't really do it. I know those are very hard, challenging things to do, but there's something about the raw dirt, mud, rope, obstacles. There's something about it that triggers the change.
Yeah. Do you think it's because, you know, you can, like, my preference is I'll go put some heavy weight on a bar and try to lift some heavy shit. I've done 2 Spartan races, but there is something different about the elements. Is that what you think? It's more, I guess, that primal instinct that comes out, and it's just maybe we don't have the tools to get that energy somewhere. Like, we live in this society of suppression, deflection. We don't really get that energy out of us, and it just provides that perfect vessel or outlet to just get back into nature and get that energy somewhere.
There's something definitely about the nature. I mean, they've done studies where they took people, same exact workout indoors and outdoors, you get better results outdoors. So there's a lot of stuff probably we still don't understand, but there's definitely a component that, because it's outside, because it's raw, might be raining, usually is at a Spartan race, there's usually some tornado or something happening when we put on an event. And then don't forget the community. You don't necessarily have a giant community around you when you're squatting. You do have a giant community, right? So there's that energy, the other people, maybe the fact that the other people around you are changing. So I'm not tooting our brand's horn or anything and saying, oh, it's just like, but there is, you know, you've done 2 of them. There's something different about doing it out. Well, you know, if you go out for a run in the pouring rain and it's cold and you're a little cold, you're like, it's different than running on a treadmill indoors. It's just different. I mean, the greatest analogy I used that maybe people will get is, I love dogs. And so if I come home and my dog is on the couch, hypothetically, and smoking a cigarette and watching TV, and maybe the dog even gets up for, does some push-ups or squat or whatever, like, we're being silly, right? Versus coming home and the dog is outside running in the mud, chasing a bird. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that dog outside is a different animal. It feels different. It's happier. It's more like than the one inside. Yeah. So we're animals, you and I. We're animals.
Yeah. And we're constantly in this environment of, I'm sure you experienced that, sitting at a desk in Wall Street and not seeing much sunlight on a day-to-day basis. Was that the thing for you? Like, personally, was just feeling almost like a prisoner to the day-to-day grind and just needing something different outside?
I just want to be outside. My dream would be, I just want to be outside chopping wood, digging. Yeah, my dream is just go outside every day and do work. I sit all day every day. I stand all day every day in an office and type emails and do podcasts and do communications. And that's not my dream. That's not my dream. My dream is to be out there.
How do we move towards more of that? Because it seems that we become less and less in touch with that, like, that we are animals, that we do need to be outside. We do need to do hard shit. It's like, It's almost become more difficult to put yourself in difficult situations, if that makes sense. Everything is convenient. I can order food with a delivery app. I can get picked up from wherever I want. I don't have to walk anywhere if I don't want to. How do we get back towards what we actually need to feel more alive?
You know, I mean, we give it to people for a moment, but even if we get back to we're at like 1.2, 1.3 million registrations this year is our budget. Even if we get back to 1.5, 1.7, my goal is to get to 2 million registrations each year. That's a tiny little speck, you know, when you look at the size of the globe's population. And I just feel like the whole world is fighting you and I. I have these conversations. I tell people what to do. I put on camps for kids. And yes, we get the 1.2, 1.3 million, maybe two. But most people say, why would I do that? Pretty comfortable inside. Like, why would I do that? And not to sound like a conspiracist or like, at the end of the day, is certainly in a democracy and within our capitalism, right? It's like the thing that sells the most is being consumed the most, or the thing that's being consumed the most, it, you know, sells the most. So like phones, Netflix, comfy couches. That's a nod to my buddy that owns Lovesac. I'm always joking with him and telling him he's killing everybody with his awesome couches. People want those things. Now, if Google and Samsung and Apple and Meta came together, imagine this, let's just have some fun. And they said, okay, every 5 minutes, every 3 minutes, whatever, the phone's going to go dark. It's going to ask you a really difficult math question. It's going to make you learn a new language. It's going to force you to do three burpees. In the morning, it's going to tell you to do cold showers. Like, it's almost going to be like a public service announcement, right? Everybody, like, that would be incredible because the thing is so damn addictive that it can actually, I used it. My kids learn Mandarin because if they want to keep their phone, they had to learn Mandarin. They learn Mandarin. They speak fluent Mandarin. So anyway, if we could use the really addictive things in our lives that we know are having negative consequences to force us to do the things we need to do, then we have a shot. Otherwise, I don't know. I mean, I look at my kids. Sorry, I'm rambling here, but I look at my kids. My kids work out a lot. I forced a lot of working out. They're part of high level sports teams. They work out a lot with their coaches. They've done it so much for so long that it's actually addictive now for them. Like we've imprinted it in their brain. But if the other kids haven't done that, they don't. Why would they do that? Why would they work that hard?
You think that people would just ignore it? Like thinking about that alert on the phone, go do, you know, 10 burpees. How many people would just,
if they want their phone to come back, like I'm suggesting it turns off. You can only make an emergency call. Unless you do the thing it's asking, you're out. Then you got a shot.
Yeah. That makes more sense. You mentioned your kids, you mentioned having camps for kids. Yeah. One of my mentors always has the line, it's easier to raise strong kids than to fix broken adults. But I see the younger, I have three stepkids. Fortunately, they're very into working out. And just, you know, my wife and I were at the gym pretty frequently. So they just observed the behavior and picked it up and love it. But there's also the obsession with TikTok and Netflix and all the things. I see that the younger generation heading into more convenience, more cheap dopamine hits. So that's the part that actually is more concerning in the sense that we seem to be moving in the wrong direction, unless I'm just being pessimistic. What are your thoughts?
Definitely moving in the wrong direction. I mean, think about the generations before us. I mean, a few generations back, it was horseback. A few generations before that, what was it, right? Like, then we had automobiles that probably shook us up a bit. And we had television sets. And now we got these damn phone devices, Uber Eats. I mean, it's come so fast for this next generation. Unless the kids are grounded in sport, and whatever the sport is, we don't have to spend a lot of money on hockey equipment and play out, like something that's taking up an hour, 2 hours a day, every day. Grinding them, making them know what hard work is, and doing it with a community around them. Like, now, by the way, it could be piano. Maybe you and I probably, I know I believe, I'm sure you believe, no matter what we do, as we all have to exercise, like it just makes us better. But maybe, you know, the kid is grinding on the piano or the violin or mathematics. That's okay. But they have to exercise every day, every day. And stop with all these ridiculous articles talking about, oh, you only need 90 minutes a week, or it looks like conservatives exercise more than they should. Like, all nonsense. Every day, go sweat. You'll be happier. And by the way, if you have something bad that's gone on in your life, which probably everybody has, don't go hit the bottle. Don't go hit the drugs. Go exercise.
Yeah, it's the low-hanging fruit that a lot of us ignore. Yeah. For some. I want to take a brief pause in this conversation with Joe to tell you all about Organifi. Organifi is really helping me out a lot lately because I have been making sure that I get my green juice in the morning. I've been making sure that I get my gold chocolate in the evening. But the other thing that I've been doing is hitting the Sheila Jeet gummies hard. So I have been a little bit run down this week and have needed an extra kick, you can say, to get my workouts in, to show up on the tennis court. And the Sheila Jeet gummies, it's a wonderful adaptogen. If you have not looked into Sheila Jeet, do yourself a favor and check it out, because you will be pretty pleased with what all of the research has to say. Powerful adaptogen, helps with focus, energy, but like most adaptogens, kind of has multi-use in terms of why it's so valuable. But the Sheila Jeet gummies, number one, I love me some gummies. It's kind of like a little treat during the day. So I take them every single day, even if I'm not working out, because they are such a powerhouse. But Organifi is just constantly putting out the best quality ingredients, best quality products. So I highly recommend the green juice. Crisp apple is so delicious. Great way to start your morning. The gold chocolate, great way to finish the day. And then the Sheila Jeet gummies, I also take their immunity when I feel like I might be getting sick. Their collagen is another great choice. But you get 20% off by being a Mind Over Macros listener. That's 20% off all of their products, everything. So if you go to Organifi.com/popfam, you can get 20% off. Use the code popfam at checkout. That's Organifi.com/popfam. Use the code popfam. Check out all the products that they have, but you know my favorites, right? Green, crisp apple, gold chocolate, Sheila Jeet. Mel loves the harmony. Also want to mention the immunity and the collagen. Organifi.com/popfam. Code is popfam. And now let's get back to the episode. So what's you seem like the type of person, we obviously just met, so I apologize if this is not accurate, but you seem like one of those people that has this internal belief that like you can make an impact on the world at like a grand scale, obviously to build a brand the way that you did. So what's that vision for you? Like what's the mark or the legacy or however you want to frame it? Like what's your hope in terms of where you're heading right now with Spartan, or just you personally and the changes that you'd like to imprint on the world, really?
Well, the goal is to change 100 million lives, still a small number relative to 8 billion on the planet. And maybe I get a free pass to heaven if I change 100 million lives. But I'm fueled, just I'm sure you are, anybody listening is. When I hear, hey, I'm back with my husband, I'm back with my wife, I gave up alcohol, I gave up drugs, I lost 400 pounds, I didn't kill myself. I get those stories all day, every day. We get them as a company. And so, you know, if I was selling cheese or sunglasses, or it wouldn't feel as exciting, but it's so damn rewarding and so purposeful that I'm addicted to it. I just want more. I just want to change more lives.
What was the, do you still participate? Do you still do a lot of the races or your own challenges?
Very, very slowly. Yes. I'll go out. I'll slowly jog, walk, courses. I'll carry a sandbag here and there, but I'm more interested in, and I want to see the people out there. I like to do the course backwards, because backwards I'm seeing, one face, two. When you're running with them, you're not necessarily interacting with folks. So when I go backwards and I've got my phone and I can capture stories as I'm going, I love it.
Yeah. So one of my favorite pictures of myself is my first ever Spartan. And there's a picture of me jumping over the fire. Highest I've ever jumped in my life. Everybody who says I can't jump, I was like, I have one picture to prove that there was a moment that something just came alive and that it just looks like I'm a person underneath me. And I just, the only regret is that I didn't have a basketball and a hoop to dunk, because I've never been able to dunk a basketball. That would have been the moment. But yeah, there is something about it that just, it brings you to life.
Brings you to life. It turns the lights on. Maybe that's our saying. It turns your lights on. Where are you physically located?
I'm outside of Philadelphia.
Outside of Philly. So we got to look on the schedule when the next race is, and you should energize your whole community. I'll give you races, no charge. Bring out a bunch of folks, put the name of the podcast on some t-shirts, have set up a tent. It's all on me, no charge. And it's a great way, as you're building your community, your business, whatever it is you're building, your tribe, you know this, you've been to some of our races, but doing that hard thing together will really, really energize what you're doing.
Oh yeah, I love that. My community would absolutely love that too. We're always looking for opportunities to get. I had my whole team out in at a conference, and it was education. But just being able to get together and do something like that was so.
I have a friend. He brought 1,000 people. It was on me. Brought 1,000, and that just catapulted his business. So however, whatever you need, anybody listening could email me as well, joe@spartan.com. Let's organize that. Let's find a Tough Mudder or a Spartan that's closest to you. And it's all on me. You'll have some fun.
Appreciate it. Now, did you take over Tough Mudder as well?
We did. We bought Tough Mudder just before the pandemic, and absolute terrible timing, disaster. But we're here today. I don't know how the hell we survived, but we have survived.
Amazing. I have to hear the Iditarod story. What made you do that?
So I was doing these races, and the team I was doing them with was very, very advanced. To give you an idea of how advanced, one of the people I was racing with, you've heard of Badwater out in Death Valley. It's a 135-mile run. It goes from the lowest elevation in the United States to the highest. And my buddy, these guys that I was racing with, guys and girls, ran it, turned around at the finish, ran back to the start, self-supported, then decided to turn around again, ran back to the finish, then decided to turn around again and run back. But nobody talks about these guys. Like, the guys I was doing this stuff with were like another level, well beyond any influencer that the biggest endurance influencers everybody gets excited about. You have no idea how crazy these people were. And I got sucked into that because, remember, the race I was first introduced to was a 3,100-mile foot race. I want to run a 1-mile loop in Queens. So like, if you're a young child and you get introduced to something that big, like 5Ks, 10, it's all silly stuff, right? Because in your mind, that was the first thing you saw. So anyway, I started doing these crazy races, and I say to these guys, like, what's the toughest race? And they said, oh, the Iditarod by foot. I said, sign me up. We got to do it. I had I was way out of my league. You got no idea what I was doing, but we trained and we went and did a race called the Yucatec in Northern Quebec 30 days before we were planning to do the race in Alaska. And the Yucatec was meant to be like a gimme, like head up to Northern Quebec, knock this thing out in 3-4 days. It's a little snowy. It'll get us, tuned up for the big one in Alaska, which was like 14, 15 days. And Yucatec was terrible. It was minus 30. And there was a moment where we almost died, literally. And it was not what we thought. Like, it was not a tune-up run. It was crazy town. We should not have continued on to Alaska. But thank God we did it, because it definitely got me through Alaska. There was a moment in Alaska where, one of the teammates, one of the guys who was, again, way more advanced than me, we didn't know how far we were to getting to a finish line. And anytime you came across an Eskimo, we'd ask, like, you know, where is so-and-so or how far? And it was the same answer you got, no matter, like, if it was a day later or 10 hours, like, you know, it was 5 hours. Like, they had no concept of time. So the first time you hear 5 hours, you could live with that. The second time it's five, you're losing your mind. The third time, the fifth time, it's still 5 hours. We've been going 24 hours. Like, anyway, this guy, Ben, my teammate at the time, he collapsed and he laid in the snow and it's extremely cold. And I motivate him. I get him up and I tie him to me. I tie the front of his backpack to the back of my backpack. And I say, Ben, every time I take a step, you take a step. I'm not leaving him out there. And this guy would untie the rope and he would fall back in the snow. And I'm losing my mind. And they're telling me 5 hours and Ben keeps untying the rope. And I'm exhausted and I'm pissing on myself because you can't even take your pants. Like, it was crazy. And we finally got to the town and I couldn't find the finish line. So there was a FedEx with a light on. It was like the only light, like all the houses were dark. It's like 2 a.m. and I propped Ben up. I couldn't keep pulling him. I propped him up at the FedEx and I was going to go find the finish and a warm cup of soup and a plate, like, and come back and get him. And I finally did about an hour later. I left him there for about an hour. I found the finish, found everybody. Then I had to go back out and go get him. And that was probably the hardest part. That was probably the hardest moment of that event. I haven't been back to Alaska since.
What's the fueling look like for that?
Yeah, we carried a lot of our own stuff along the way. There were places to stop and grab some things. There was a cabin at one point. There was an igloo. We went into this tiny little igloo with this Eskimo family, and I felt like the Four Seasons, because just getting out of, you know, the exposure. There was a Marine we ran into in the middle of nowhere that was dragging a carcass back to his hut, where he had a child and a wife, and he let us in, and he was making some kind of soup. I don't know. It could have been, I don't know what it was. Well, you know, whatever he had killed out there was ground up and being boiled. So there were moments like that along the way where we were able to get some fuel.
And then where my twisted mind goes is, what do you do when you have to take a shit?
You deal with it. I mean, it's cold. I mean, I've got some video. It was so hard for me to take my hands out of my gloves to hold the video, to just capture something. Imagine what it was like to try to take your pants off and go to bed. It was tough.
Great. And then how long, when the run in Queens, how long does that take?
50 to 60 days.
And you just...
Just run around in circles. Yeah.
Then do you stop and sleep?
Most competitors, about 7 or 8 competitors per year attempt it. They'll sleep in their car and wake up in the morning and start running again.
That's wild. And you did that too?
I did not do that event. No. I saw it at a young age.
Okay. I can imagine if that was your first exposure. It was kind of like, it was almost like you saw the 4-minute mile that opened.
Exactly. And that sets a new, right? Like a frame of reference of where you should be in life.
It calibrates you a little bit differently.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for somebody who is in that, you know, any kind of struggle, hardship, whatever, life's life, you know, you're kind of going through the motions. You feel like something's missing. What are like some of the easy, simple action steps that somebody can do right now without having to go, run a marathon, or maybe that is the first step. What do you feel like is?
I mean, I vote you have to sign up for something hard. You have to. We all have to. When you sign up for something hard, it could be a fight with Tyson. It could be a marathon. It could be it could be going to learn a new language, speaking to that person, going up on stage. Sign up for something hard. And then that forces action to be taken in your life. You put down the cookie, you go to bed early, you drink less, you wake up early. You'll do the work to achieve the thing that you have on the calendar. If you don't have something on the calendar, 99% of the people, 99.9% of the people just keep going through their everyday life the way they are. And so unless you wake up every day and say, this is, everything is perfect. It can't be any better. Like, if you're that person, don't bother putting anything on the calendar. You're one in 8 billion.
Yeah. Yeah. It almost becomes a forcing function for everything else. So it's just the act of signing up, which doesn't take any, you know, you find the event, put it on the calendar, and that becomes a forcing function for everything else.
That forces everything. People used to say to me all the time, I'm not going to sign up because I'm not ready. I'm not in shape. I'm like, you're an idiot. You sign up and it gets you in shape. You don't sign up when you're in shape. If you signed up when you're in, you'd already be in shape, but you're not in shape.
That's what people treat coaching like that. Yeah. We do nutrition, fitness, and it's like, well, let me take this month and do all these things first. You're never going to do that. That's why we're having this conversation.
Exactly.
So with the objective of changing, you said 100 million?
100 million lives, yeah.
Do you put a timeline or you just say it's going to take however long it takes? Do you give yourself a deadline?
I didn't give myself a deadline. That's an interesting point. And COVID came in and no excuses. I just don't think we could ever get past 2 million registrations per year. I've done 10 million so far. I got 90 to go. We just released, I'm thinking and speaking at the same time to answer that question. We just released the app. The app could maybe help us go a little wider than the restriction of actually holding events and getting people to come out and do. I guess I have to get it done before I'm dead. That's my goal.
That works. Do you have a favorite favorite city, country to host races?
I mean, listen, there's a bunch of them I love. For this year, certainly Abu Dhabi, in the middle of the desert. Anybody who's old enough to have seen some of those old, like Casablanca movies or cartoons where you'd see, you know, the cartoon character in the desert completely out of water, or Chevy Chase in the Three Amigos. Like, I always wanted to just be out in the dunes. And so Abu Dhabi opened up that world to us, like way out in the middle of the desert. It's epic. It's a place everybody has to go to. Croatia, we have a world championship in Croatia. Morzine, France. Killington, Vermont. Montana. Who doesn't want to go to Montana? Fiji. I mean, you know, there's so many events and so many unbelievable places.
Yeah, really cool. When do you kind of, you know, you sign up for the event, you go through the process, you probably, I'm sure a lot of people finish, then at some point they're like, all right, we got to sign up for the next one. Even for your own journey of some of the crazy races that you've done, when do you kind of hit that point of like, all right, I'm ready to not push it to the next level, but now I'm kind of in this maintenance mode of, you know, you're still doing hard things, but it's, we've kind of pushed the limits. Like when do you
get for me, it's interesting you say that, right? For me, I definitely learned right away that, oh my God, when I have something on the calendar, it's awesome. It's forcing all the functions we just spoke about. But everything I was doing had to be harder, harder, harder. The final hard was a buddy of mine said, let's go set a world record. We're going to climb the 7 highest peaks in the world. And when we get to the summit of each, we're going to start a stopwatch and race to sea level. No one's ever done it before. It's a cool little challenge. And we started, and I went down and did Aconcagua. And what I found was I spent a lot of time acclimatizing on the mountain, and I wasn't running. And I was sleeping in a tent with somebody I didn't know, waiting to, you know, acclimatize and then make another push up higher. It was a lot of time just sitting, and I don't sit very well. And so I backed out. I didn't continue on. I said, you know, climbing's really not for me unless it's a continuous, unless we're like running, and you can't do that when you're over, you know, 19, 20,000 feet. It's a different animal. He continued on. He died recently climbing. So there is a moment where, you know, you do have to get into maintenance mode, to your point. I met my wife. We had 4 children. We had a farm. Like, So I had a different, like, okay, I'm going to be on a side of a mountain for 14 days acclimatizing away from my family. Mm-mm. If I was single and I was proving something to myself and we're writing a book about it, you deal with it. Right. So it just depends where you are in your life is my thought.
Yeah. And I'm asking, cause I think a lot of times we don't push. I mean, even with, you know, when we're just talking about basic training, when somebody says, oh, you know, push yourself to failure, on a set, most people stop at least four reps, four reps in reserve without going to failure. So there's the mental where your mind tells you it's enough. Then there's what you're actually capable of. And then there's the point where maybe, you know, you reach that, all right, now it's actually time to stop. So just trying to think through that of when do we push through the initial barrier and when is enough actually enough?
It's a billion-dollar question that I've been wrestling with for a long time, and I'm sure you have. And I'm actually I'm just starting a book on it right now, because what happens is our brain from the very beginning of those first few reps is telling us, the brain's telling us not to even go to the gym, right? It's protecting us because it needed to 100,000 years ago. Then when we're in the gym, it's telling us at the second rep to stop. But you know you can get 10. And you get to 10 and the brain is like circuit breakers, whistles, bells are going off. But you might have two more. You might even be able to get to 20. At some point you start doing damage. So where are we supposed to stop? Where are we supposed to continue? A silly thing I've said throughout the years for 25, 30 years doing this is, are you pissing blood? If you're not pissing blood, carry on. Right? Because I've been in runs where my teammates pissing blood. All right, well, we got to stop. If you're pissing blood, we can't continue. Right? But obviously that's too extreme. You can't make that the barometer of when you stop. And I've recently come to the conclusion that it really depends on what your why is in life. Again, if you've got kids and you want to be the greatest family man ever, and you know you're bumping up against a place where it's starting to become dangerous, you turn around because your purpose isn't to set the world record in these squats, right? You don't have to get 52. You might break your back. But if you grew up in Iceland and this is your chance and you're feeling good that day and you're single and like you're supposed to go to you piss blood. I had one of our athletes, we sponsor some athletes in different sports. One of our athletes was in a recent Olympics and he didn't want to take, I forget the name of the drug that would have eliminated the pain in his foot. And when I spoke to his coach, friend of mine, the coach says, look, if it was a regular tournament, you don't get the injection. It's the fucking Olympics. You've worked a long time to get here. You take the injection. You know, illegal, you know, it's allowed. So really delicate analysis required to know when to stop, when to push through. Much more difficult because in those moments when that delicate analysis is required, the brain is on fire. Every circuit breaker you have is turned off, bells are like, so you can't even think clearly. That's the problem.
So one, it's funny when I typically get podcast guests, usually I'll get a bunch of information beforehand. And transparently, I rarely ever look at it because I prefer conversations like this. We hit record, we chat back and forth, and that is what my own, you know, I'm selfish. So it's personal preference thing. But there was something that was brought up in talking about you, which was that stood out to me. So this is probably the first time that I've ever actually referenced something from notes on a guest, which was, I can't remember exactly how it was phrased, but it was something about the habits to happiness. And that's something that you like to discuss, the habits of happiness.
So if we're talking about the same thing, I've been thinking about happiness for a long time. And I believe most people have it wrong. I believe if our life was described as a horizontal line on a whiteboard, and that's where we were, just imagine a horizontal line on a whiteboard, most of us, 99.9% of us, are trying to move up the board. Nicer girlfriend, nicer boyfriend, more money, nicer house, better car. We want to inch up the whiteboard. Because when we inch up the whiteboard, we'll be happy. We just get that other job. We just get that other car. We just meet that other person. We're going to be happy. The reality is, I'm absolutely convinced we're going in the wrong direction. We need to go below the line. We need to take things away from our life. And when we do that, whether it's food, whether it's comfort, whether it's you, the car, whatever it may be, and you go below the line and you suffer a little bit, when you get back to the line, you are happy as can be. I've slept on the floor on rocks. I've said to my friends, these are the most comfortable rocks I've ever slept on because I was so exhausted, right? I've had friends who would return steaks at the fanciest restaurants, come out with me in the woods for 3 or 4 days and eat with their hands burnt burgers that fell in the dirt and say, this is the best burger I've ever had because they were hungry. So I believe a person that has everything appreciates nothing. A person that has nothing appreciates everything. Seneca, great philosopher from way back when, one of the richest guys in the world, if not the richest at the time, was smart enough to recognize that he had to go and live like a bum every month to appreciate all the things he had, to kind of level set, change his frame of reference. So I think happiness comes from taking things away from our life, not adding things to our life.
You think it's because it forces us to get more internal, introspective? Like if we're always looking at the external thing, then happiness is never where we are, right? It's the paradoxical. If I'm always searching for it, it's never here. So it's the next job, the next raise, the next, person, promotion, whatever. But when
I think it's even simpler than that. I think it just doesn't taste good when you're full. Yeah. You know what I mean? Think about how many psychologists we have in this country. We have 500,000, maybe it's much more than that now. Go down to the worst third world country we could find. It's probably one. Right? People are just trying to survive. They're just trying to get by. Just give me a warm meal. There's a Spartan prayer. We took it from a French paratrooper who died in World War II. They found him in the field. And in his pocket, they found a prayer. He's dead. They pulled out the prayer, and the prayer said, God, everybody's asking you for the good stuff. They want the warm meal. They want to get back with their girlfriend. They want to go home. They want a hot shower. You probably don't have any of that left. So give me the worst shit you've got. Give me the torment, the toil, the storm. Give me the strength to deal with it. And just promise me, God, that you'll keep it coming. And when I thought about that, that's very powerful. I get chills. I've said it 10,000 times. Right? It's a very powerful statement. But give me the bad stuff. Give me the hardship. Give me the struggle. You know this. And give me the strength to deal with it. That's the thing everybody, that's what we talk about, right? That's the journey. And it's all about the journey. It's all about I love this topic so much. The ancient samurai, they knew it. When they went to bed at night, they would burn all their possessions in their mind. They'd burn their friends, their family, their swords, everything. And when they woke up in the morning, they had all this happiness because their family wasn't gone. Their building wasn't burned down. They actually had they appreciated it. So I don't know. I think it's more than that.
Yeah, it's the gratitude, obviously, appreciating what you have once you have been to that darker place. That's interesting about the samurai. That's to me, when you were saying that, it's almost like you can't take, everything's already been taken from me, so there's nothing left. Like I've already
nothing left.
Pretty yeah. Weathered the greatest storm.
Right.
There's different perspective.
People say to me, how was the flight? I say, well, it landed. Didn't have to land. How can I complain about the flight? How's your day? I'm alive. I could be dead. It's pretty fucking good day.
Anything you do to keep that perspective? Because I think what I notice with a lot of people is we are almost reminded of that perspective when bad shit happens. So I lost, lost a family member, dog, whatever. Some tragedy happened. And then it's like, oh, remember, we gotta appreciate the days that we have. And it's almost like a reminder. Is there anything you do to stay in that frame of mind without needing the constant reminder?
I mean, I say it a lot. My mother used to say, and I believe it, words are really powerful. So I say it a lot internally and externally. And invariably, you know, I hear about some. I was on a phone today with somebody who has cancer, a couple of people actually, and I'm always just reminded. And you just need to pinch yourself. I say to my kids, you want to be successful in life. There's only three things you got to do. You got to communicate like a movie star, like we're doing here, right? You're doing a podcast. You become better at it. I become better at it as a guest. You got to outwork everybody. Work like an immigrant, I say, which is probably politically incorrect. And then the third thing is you have gratitude like a monk. You've got to be that grateful about everything you have. Even when you're going through hardship, you've got to say, I get to do this. I get to be in the storm. Other people, like there's people that are dead that would cut their arm. My mother said to me when I was a kid, maybe I got it at a very young age. Her mother had died. The very mother that started this whole, right, that had cancer. My mother had died. She said, I would cut my right arm off right now to have my mother back. I'm a 10-year-old kid. I can't even how do I reconcile that? But then you get it as you get older. And so, you know, if she could do it again, right, at that moment, she'd really appreciate those moments with her mom. And so then if you're me, you start appreciating everything. It could be worse.
Do you find that you get caught in the future pacing of, you know, it's like this balance of being grateful, living in the present, but then also you have goals that are in the future. I want to hit, you know, 2 million registrations for this, you know, at some point. So there's like the future pacing, but then I also want to stay in this moment.
I just try to add value every day, right? To myself, to the business. I just try to add value every single day. I was probably future pacing when I was younger, like we all do. I was much more impatient and really focused on the future. But now it's just like, all right, you know, the ancient Spartans would say, don't focus on building legacy. You know, everybody wants to build these big buildings, this and that. And just focus on doing an incredible job right now. If you do an incredible job right now, that'll lead to something great. And 2,500 years later, you and I are talking about them. Neda, there's no giant buildings in Sparta. There's nothing. They just did a great job.
I appreciate it. Where can everybody learn more about you, sign up for Spartan? Anything
they should all, yeah, your whole audience should come to you. You collect all the emails of the people that are interested, pick a race, anywhere, 10 races, I don't care. And we'll get a bunch of free entries out. And you could find me on Instagram, at Real Joe DeSena. You could send me an email, joe@spartan.com. That's funny. I was just thinking about those commercials. Like anywhere toys are sold. And it's not anywhere hard is sold.
Anyway. Well, I appreciate the time and the wisdom. Any parting words? I always like to leave somebody with something they can do right now, action item, just one thing that will improve their life.
Change your life. Here's a guaranteed one I'll give you. Do 30 burpees every morning when you wake up. Change your whole life. 30 burpees every morning.
All right. There's the challenge. All right. Actually, I'm going to follow up. So when we get everybody together at the Spartan race, I'm going to see who followed through on the 30 burpees.
Make that the buy-in. That's the buy-in.
Right. So my real quick before we jump off, the first Spartan race I did, completed every obstacle except one. Do you know which one I failed?
Spear throw.
In spear. Every other one got through it. 30 burpees.
Spear throw is torture.
Is that common?
Yeah.
All right. I don't feel so bad. All right. Appreciate the time. And I'll make sure that I get everything coordinated. Everyone go follow Joe. And I appreciate you and talk soon.
You're awesome.